Hey, everybody. Welcome back to the Son of a Blitch podcast. I am your host, George Blitch, and this is going to be a very, very fun episode for y'all to tune into. My guest today is Jesse Griffiths. You guys might know him from owning the restaurant Dai Due in Austin, his cooking and hunting school, New School of Traditional Cookery. You can learn about both of those at daidue.com, daidue.com. And you might be familiar with his cookbooks, A Field, as well as The Hog Book, which won a James Beard Award as well. And now, as of today, technically yesterday, but now he is offering the pre-orders for the latest cookbook, The Turkey Book. This book is phenomenal. It takes you through the journey of his last turkey hunting season, where he goes to Texas, Georgia, Oregon, and Connecticut. He's got so many wonderful buddies that are with him. Ben O'Brien's there, Jean-Paul Bourgeois, you got Jonathan Wilkins, you got Elias Cairo, Brad Leone, Dan Miser. I mean, just some really wonderful people and great chefs. And what are they doing after they're hunting? They're cooking some wild turkey and they're sharing those recipes. You got Jody Horton and Sam Everett that are there taking photos along the way. Some phenomenal photography in this book. And, you know, Jesse really upped his game in writing, man. These are the narrative and him writing through this and talking about the dishes that are created in their time out in the field. It's really, really entertaining and educational. I mean, it's hard to put this book down. My wife, Meg, can attest. I was reading it every single night and then flipped it over and started it again. I love this book. It's great. I think you guys are all going to enjoy it, get something from it. You know, and as far as like the cookbook nature of things, there's an index of cuts on, you know, each page. Will talk about, you know, if you're going to be doing the thighs, if you're going to be doing the wings, if you're going to be doing the breast, if you're going to be doing some slow cooking stuff. There's just a little bit of something for everyone, no matter how you want to cook it. There's something there for you. And there's a lot of inclusions of not only Jesse's dishes, but some of, you know, the guys I just mentioned too. There's a lot of their dishes that are in there as well. So you kind of get a taste and flavor and, you know, background from a lot of different chefs from all across the country that are bringing together, I think, the best representation of cooking turkey and turkey hunting that is out there. So you guys go over to thewildbooks.com today and place your pre-order for this book. There's also going to be some package deals with the Turkey Federation where you can get a membership and you can get a little discount on the book too. So go check out those bundles. I mean, there's going to be some really cool stuff for you guys to check out on that website. Go order the Hog Book if you haven't already. That is just a phenomenal book as well. I can't say enough about all the wonderful things Jesse's been part of and just a stand-up great guy who really cares about conservation and educating people and teaching people to teach others. It's infectious. He's got a great spirit. I love sitting down with him. He's a great guy. And I think you guys are going to learn a lot from him and be entertained by this podcast. So without further ado, here is my podcast with Jesse Griffiths. Y'all enjoy. Jesse, how you doing today, man?
I'm great. How have you been, George?
I've been really good, man. You had a good hunting season so far?
I've had Yes, I have. It's been fairly mellow. I'm saving myself for spring. So, I mean, I feel like I've got so many expendable days per year, and I put them in the bank in fall and winter, and I'm going to cash them in the spring. So it's been a good one, but it's really going to get going here in a little while.
So obviously we got turkey season coming up. Yesterday you just announced the arrival of the Turkey Book. You started pre-orders. Man, just let's lay that out a little bit, man. This is a fascinating book. You sent me a digital copy. I went through it, and it is phenomenal. Why don't you go ahead and just kind of maybe set up to the listeners what this one is about, what they're going to come to expect from the Turkey Book.
Yeah, well, thank you, first off. I appreciate the kind review.
Cheers.
We put this one together pretty fast, you know, and conceptually, I always say this all the time. It's like dress for the job you want. And I'm like, I want to do some more turkey hunting. And so the best way to justify that sometimes is to write a book about it, which is what I decided to do. And as it developed conceptually, I realized that I didn't want to repeat the Hog Book. I didn't want to just do like just all the butchery and everything kind of like encapsulated the same way. And what it really kind of panned out and became in the end was more of a journal where we just took the slice of one season. We started in Texas, which, you know, is further south, and the season opened earlier, and then we ended up in Connecticut, you know, in late or probably mid to late May of the same season, and just kind of decided to take it as almost like a journal with a ton of recipes in it. And so, like I said, we started in Texas, then we went to Georgia, then we went to Oregon, and then went to Connecticut. So we hit some very diverse geographic regions. It's very diverse cultural regions and hunted for different turkeys and very different circumstances with a bunch of very, I think, interesting people that were either chefs that loved to hunt turkeys or turkey hunters that loved to cook turkeys. And so what that gave us was this like multiple perspectives and inputs as far as hunting turkeys and also how to cook them. And then we were cooking them in real time. And as we were cooking turkeys in camp, which I think is really important. It's just like, I like to eat turkey while I'm turkey hunting. Sorry. You know, and it's like, so, you know, we'd get one and we'd cook the liver and the gizzard or we'd throw a leg in the crock pot or this or that. And then we would document that as we went. Sometimes I'm cooking, sometimes they're cooking. And so we got a lot of recipes out of it that way, as long as a lot of really just great hunting stories, I thought. I mean, just like real, yeah. Some of them were kind of, you know, boring, you know, I mean, the boring stuff didn't really make the book, you know, like I'm not going to document sitting under a tree for seven hours. I think anybody that's ever been turkey hunting knows what your legs feel like after that happens. Right. We had a run in with a poacher. We had, we got scooped on public land. Somebody shot our bird. We had instant success. We had long waits. We had name it bad weather. You know, it was like hot. It was snowing all over the place. And so that really influenced those stories a lot. And then the ability to weave in some of the real time recipes. And then in between, we took some of the hog book approach and doing some butchery diagrams, which, you know, it's turkeys, it's a lot smaller, doesn't require the same like finesse and variety that you would approach a hog with, or a deer for that matter. But there, I think there is a lot of really interesting butchery that can be done with turkeys that will just improve how they cook and just improve your overall experience with eating them. And so kind of diverged into that between chapters and then addressed the different major parts of the turkey and then did banks of recipes in between. Like as between these hunts, I'd be like playing around at home and being like, I'm going to try this with turkey. And so just creating a lot more recipes to go along with it. And I think we ended up with about 115 recipes. And all of them, I really wanted all the recipes to be very unique, you know, something new. It's, if it was a classic recipe, I wanted to add a new twist. If it was something that I could present a technique, you know, like here's how to just simply roll enchiladas, but then we provide four different sauces after that. So I think that, you know, building up people's kind of Rolodex of skills in the kitchen is really important too. And as you compile books or watch YouTube videos and stuff, and you start to get familiar with how to make a certain type of dish, then you can start to vary from that. And I think that really gives people confidence in the kitchen. So we focused a lot on that too, as far as recipes. Delved into culture and history and little things like that, like the role of the NWTF, and just talking to people that were in conservation and all kinds of stuff, land management. We just tried to weave as much as we could in there, and all told, turned it around pretty quick, got it to the printer. And if you know, fingers crossed, it should be here right before turkey season. Which would be a pretty fast turnaround considering that we went on these turkey hunts last turkey season. So,
yeah, that's a super fast turnaround. I mean, most people I know working on books, it's like a 2-year thing, man. I mean, it for you to be able to knock this out and within that, before the next season starts, you have this book in hand. Congratulations on that, man. I mean, it's a phenomenal book. I was very impressed. I've always thought you were a good writer from, you know, reading, you know, other books and just times you've maybe posted things, and you're very eloquent, and this really took it to another level. I really enjoyed reading along with the hunts and kind of getting, you know, your perspective on different things that were happening, and just kind of obviously the wild world of unpredictable turkeys, man. You just never know what's going to happen. And there's some really funny stories in there, and there's some serious stuff too. And I'll jump into that in a little bit, but I kind of wanted to ask about, as far as, you know, Jesse the writer, what, when you decided that you're going to write this book and then you have these hunts, are, what does it look like for your process of writing? Are you taking notes throughout these hunts to kind of keep things fresh? Are you looking back on videos and photography and stuff to maybe kind of, you know, scoop up some of those memories? What does that look like? And then how did you, like, what was your discipline, I guess, for sitting down and actually writing it as well? So, you know, just kind of very curious about that side of things.
Well, I think to this day, I don't even consider myself a writer. I just like transcribe what I would be saying out loud, if that makes any sense.
I
would take notes on my phone, like, especially if somebody I was in the car with said something really interesting, I'd just be like, you know, like, oh, that was great. Kevin, what was, did you say that again, please? You know, and Kevin had a lot of them. Kevin Harlander, my friend, he's up in Oregon. He just has just this, a constant flow of wisdom, that, and it's just very subtle. I'm like, man, he just sitting over, it's like 4:45 in the morning and you're this smart. But I would, you know, take some notes and really just try to, you know, just mostly to preserve memory, because after 4 days of hunting, sometimes things get a little foggy, like the sequence, and especially you add in like just abject boredom and then punctuated by a lot of adrenaline, you know, just so it makes things hard to focus. And I would try to write on the plane back. So, I mean, a lot of times I was flying to these places because they're so far away. Mm-hmm. And I would try to create a skeleton of that story on the way back. And then, you know, like from there, it's just like early mornings, I just get up and, before the house really wakes up, I would just try to hammer out a little bit here and there and try to refine it. And just went from there. And, I really appreciate you saying that, because I love hunting stories. I always have. I remember when I was a kid, my parents gave me Jimmy Carter's book, The President, former president. Mm-hmm. He wrote an outdoor book on about hunting and fishing. And I had this when I was like 8. And I think it was then that I really realized that I just loved reading stories about hunting, you know, like, you know, yeah. I was sitting under the tree, and then, you know, like, and then what, you know? And so I enjoy stories. And so I think that, you know, obviously that's the approach I take too. And I hope that everybody else enjoys stories too. So that was kind of how I went about it. And I think it worked well to convey not only my voice, but the voice of all these other people that I was, you know, so lucky to hunt with.
Yeah. And there's quite a cast. I mean, in your Texas, you had Jean-Paul Bourgeois, you had Ben O'Brien, Jonathan Wilkins from Black Duck Revival was there as well. Was there anybody else that was a part of that? Am I missing?
Well, just the photographer who's the silent, invisible photographer that was there the whole time. So mostly Jody Horton, who I've worked with. This is our third book together. Yep. But in Georgia and Oregon, we worked with a new photographer who is just a recommendation and turned out to be just a real incredible human being, Sam Averett. And he came from a hunting background. And so we brought him along. His photography is phenomenal, but more so, he was also able to, like, I mean, his positioning, just the way that he moved into the woods was that of a hunter. And of course, Jody, who has always provided just the most excellent food photography and in the field photography as well. You know, so he would go out with us in Texas and in Connecticut and captured a lot of really good stuff. So, I mean, still photography in turkeys is hard. I mean, as is video. If you watch YouTube, those guys that self-film their hunts, I'm just like, you guys are insane. Like, they're so good at it. But, you know, capturing the most wary of birds with a camera can be hard. But yes, there was that was the sorry, I diverged a little bit, but was the crew from Texas. And then in Georgia, we were with Chris Jenkins, who is a conservationist, and he's a member of the BHA board. And he runs a project called the Orion Society in Southeast Georgia. And then up in Oregon, I was with Elias Cairo, who's a chef, and also my friend Kevin Harlander, who's kind of just been in the hunting industry forever. And then in Connecticut chef Dan Meiser and Brad Leone, who does a little bit of everything.
Yeah, indeed. I actually just interviewed him, and we talked like a little bit about his book too, which kind of was like a year of him going out and, you know, hunting, fishing, foraging, and cooking, and just like it was really cool, man. His book and then yours, the last two that I've really jumped in on. It's really neat to see the idea of like storylines going through, weaving in with cooking. But I feel like there's like that real time thing where, you know, like you said, you're taking pictures and you guys are cooking these dishes there, and then you're borrowing, you're like, hey, you know, Elias has this one, Brad has this one, Jean-Paul has this, and you're bringing those in and having, you know, I mean, I haven't seen a lot of cookbooks where someone puts it out and they're sharing a bunch of other people's stuff. I mean, unless it's like a big collective cookbook. And I really, really appreciated that there's just different flavors. Obviously you got Jean-Paul and what he's bringing in, that kind of Cajun style and stuff. And, you know, East Coast, everything's a little bit different and everyone has their own, you know, kind of repertoire of what they're going to bring to the table. But I really love the variety of the recipes. And I mean, it's just, man, it's such a great book. Like you said, the images are second to none, man. You've got a great team with you there, and it's just fun getting the personalities. It's a very entertaining book and educational, like, but best of both worlds, man. I love the hog book. I love a field. I've used them often. I share them with friends. I've given them as gifts. Like, those are phenomenal, and there's nothing that's taken away from that. It's just something about getting a little bit more of the story and the writing. Just really, I don't know, man. It just, it resonated with me. And I'm not trying to toot your horn too much, but like, I want to see more writing, man. That's, it was phenomenal. I loved reading everything you had, man. You weaved it together really well. I really liked how you also brought in some interesting takes. There was, I forgot the guy's, Adriano. I know I got his name here. The Italian
pop star.
Dude, yeah. I love that reference. Why don't you, can you set that up real quick? You want to go ahead and tell people a little bit about that and what your reference was there?
Yeah. You know, I think this spring we're probably, I'll get there really quick. Mm-hmm, mm-hmm. I'm buddies with the guys in the Element, you know?
Yeah.
They're phenomenal humans. I love them so much. We're going to go on a turkey hunt, and I've never been on a video turkey hunt, and I'm very nervous because my calling is atrocious. Maybe, I don't know. It works though. You know, it works. I mean, I got turkey in the freezer.
Five birds down in four states, man.
Well, to be clear, I wasn't doing all of the calling there. A lot of times Ben is like, I got you. why don't you put that thing away? I'm not the best. And I tend to overanalyze things, or maybe I just like, I just have a different perspective. And in the 70s, there was this Italian pop star. And I guess at the time, maybe he was a little bitter or frustrated that pretty much any American pop song, no matter the quality, would, you know, be at the top of the charts in Italy. And all it had to be was just like an American pop song. So he retaliated by recording this song that sounds like English, and the song is objectively great too. I mean, it's just like, it is a total banger. It is just awesome. But and you're listening to it and you're like, yeah, I mean, even as an English speaker, you're like, oh, this guy is, but what is he saying, you know? But and he's not saying anything, it's just gibberish. And so, yeah, I equated my turkey calling to that, where I think, and not to anthropomorphize turkeys too much, some people are very offended by that. I do it all the time, though. I don't care. I guess I have to latch onto some kind of perspective, you know, just some reasoning as to why the animals behave a certain way. And the only way I can, you know, figure it out is to put it in a human term. Mm-hmm. And I assume that the gobblers are just like, what is she saying? It's good enough, I guess. Like, it's a hen, I think. I don't know. But anyway, but I do kind of equate my calling with that song, which is just absolute gibberish. With the exception, he does say, all right.
All right. Yep.
Yeah. It's funny. Yeah. Any listeners out there, do yourselves a favor and go check that song out. It's very good.
Adriano Celentano. The name is like, it's 24 letters. It's you'll just have to look it up. If you just write American gibberish or something in there and do the search, Adriano Celentano. But I remember hearing this years ago and hadn't heard about that song. I mean, in like a decade, you know, I mean, obviously you and I are both way into music and stuff. So it was like, when I saw that reference, I was like, I know that. And I completely know what you're saying. There's been times I'm calling a turkey in and you're like, all right, cool. It's coming in. All of a sudden you hear like a real hen, you know, sound off and it's like turning, going the other way. I'm like, it was almost there. It was almost there. If that hen wasn't there, maybe I could have called him in. But
yeah, pretty much.
So another thing that I was wondering, and this is a very, very serious question. How did you survive a morning hunt without coffee? What happened there?
It was brutal. And I don't even know how that all went down. I mean, it's one of those things where you're the guest and, you know, I'm just keep nervously like looking around. I'm just like, where is it? You know, it's just like, I mean, there was maybe six of us in a room and it's morning. Sun's not up. And I'm like, another one of them has got to make this move. And I didn't really want to be the one. And eventually we were running so far behind because we were having to fill out our permission slips, multiples, because we were like planning on potentially hunting in like three or four different properties that day. So each one of us is filling out, this is Connecticut, by the way, mm-hmm. which I mean, and then I think my brain is just trying to grasp that as well. Like, why all the paperwork? You know, if this was Texas, it'd just be like, are you guys ready? Well, I'll probably be actually like,
don't shoot anyone. Yeah.
Here's a cup of coffee. Are you guys ready? It was very different. And so we're trying to fill these out. And I think it wasn't a common, it wasn't people being inhospitable. We were also very behind.
Sure.
And needed to get the, you know, it was starting to get light outside. We saw
a lot of people to rally. Sure.
A drive, you know, and it was just like, we gotta make this happen. Hunting without a coffee is rough. It's rough.
Yeah. Well, I mean, you know, this is like my baby blanket for Linus kind of thing. Like this, I'm keeping this around all the time. I always have coffee in it. I mean, I can be drinking it to the cheers, sir. Cheers to you.
Here's so. My coffee. Yeah.
And I just saw that and I was like, wait, what? I can't imagine a hunt without coffee, man. So it was tough, but you know, y'all got it done. So it worked out.
Yeah.
When you get back, you're like, hey guys, tomorrow morning, you got to have some coffee.
Yeah. I think we made like strong countermeasures the next day. Like there was some plotting, you know, between the other coffee drinkers, but to be clear, Ben O'Brien has never, and I repeat, has never tasted coffee. And now he's in it so far as a fully grown non-coffee consumer that he can't do it. You know what I mean? Like once you get to a certain point, you can't go back. And so Ben, my dear friend, has never tasted coffee. He's of course smelled it and seen people consuming it, but it has never passed his lips.
I love when you include that. You're like, we all had coffee and then Ben didn't because he didn't drink coffee. So he did whatever non-coffee drinkers do. Yeah, it's the mystery. What do you have? Tea and water? What clean water?
Yeah. Well, he's also a very good turkey hunter and he's very alert in the mornings.
There you go. So he doesn't need it, man. He's got that natural caffeine kicking or something, man. Good for him. So I wanted to guess, you know, I was going to ask you too about what you have planned this season. You know, you're talking about working with, you know, the LM boys, Tyler Jones, Casey Smith. Mm-hmm. I assume, you know, they're Texas based. You're probably going to be doing something in Texas. Can you kind of talk about the region you're hunting, maybe without giving too much away?
Yeah, Hill Country. We'll be out, you know, which is my favorite place to hunt turkeys in Texas. I mean, I don't know. That's a ridiculous statement. Anywhere, I don't care. In fact, I would love to be able to diversify the places I've hunted turkeys in Texas. I'll be hunting with them, I think, in early April, mm-hmm. which should be, if nothing else, peak blue bonnets, especially at this property. I went there last year, did not shoot a turkey there, but a stunning, I mean, like postcard looking property as far as blue bonnets go, like just, I mean, incredible. And then milk thistle and oaks and hills and stuff like that. So yeah, Hill Country, not too far from here, probably an hour and a half from Austin. Mm-hmm. But yeah, doing that. A lot of Texas hunts lined up, probably maybe too many. I mean, take four birds. So I can
too many turkeys. I'm sorry.
You know what I mean? Too many. Well, my fear being is that I might have. I'm getting way ahead of myself anyway. But definitely a lot of opportunities, and I will go on all of them, even if I am for some magical reason tagged out. I'll still go and carry decoys or whatever for someone else. A trip to New Mexico planned too, which I'm exceedingly excited about. I've never hunted turkeys or anything in New Mexico for that matter. I've got a lot of familial connections there. My mom's family is from New Mexico, and
oh, cool.
I've always traveled there for vacations in the summer since I was a kid. And I just love New Mexico, and finally was able to put together a trip there. It'll be all public land. You know, just a real challenge, you know, going in blind, you know, never having been even to this region, and going in and hunting, you know, pressured turkeys in the mountains. So, it's going to be hard. I mean, I'm already trying to focus on just like, if you get a bird, you're going to be like, that's going to be great, you know, like far beyond your expectations. And I'm really going into it with just like, it'll be a good way to just earn some experience, you know, in doing that and chasing them in a different spot. But also, it's turkey hunting. You might shoot one in the first 15 minutes, you know, just because you never know. And in the book, you'll notice I kill a turkey on the first day in every spot. And
another part of it is like, and you're also calling for someone else in some of those sits too. Like, they came around to you. Like, it's amazing. Like, you're like, gotta help a buddy out here, but
that is true. Well, that really drove home. And I want to be really clear when I say that I killed one on the first. I'm not good. I don't know what I am. You know, I'm a little bit lucky. But that situation where I would be, you know, I was the host in Texas, and both times I was like, hey, you're at bat here. We had a turkey, you know, and we're talking to him. And both times that turkey circled around to me and I was doing the calling. And I think that the real take home there is that you cannot underestimate their echolocation abilities. Like, they have that sound dialed to a square foot, maybe. Like, so even if you're sitting 4 feet away from your friend, they're coming to the sound of that. Mm-hmm. And they've got that so dialed. And if the brush dictates, then they're going to circle around at both times. And we always function on a, like, whoever's got the shot, take it, you know. Right. It's like, you know, I would prefer it if it was, you know, my buddy both times. And one time it was Jonathan, one time it was Jean-Paul. You know, both times I'm like, okay, buddy, you're up. And then both times I'm like, I'm doing this because, you know, we might not have another opportunity.
Sure.
So, yeah, but it was pretty incredible. And it's just one of the thousands of things that you can learn about these birds, and or discover. It's just like how truly fascinating they are, how masterful they are at living, surviving in the woods.
Yeah. What are some other takeaways that maybe, you know, maybe accumulative knowledge over the years, or something that was maybe highlighted, or something new that you learned, maybe, you know, kind of aside from that, and the idea that, yeah, they're coming to the calls and they have that, you know, direct focus. Is there some other things you kind of picked up throughout this year and, you know, working in many different states and different lands that you were on?
Yeah. I mean, I think that, like, it's, you know, it just sounds trite, but patience, you know, a lot of times you really have to slow down a lot and really just like take it easy and make more calculated decisions, except when you don't want to do that and you want to move very quickly and make very quick decisions. That's a total non-answer. But I think most of the time I would be better served personally in my approach to slowing it down a little bit and not overthinking it, and also realizing that they might be on their way. And that's what I love about watching other more experienced hunters is how they can often tell that they're on the way, or they're like, I think he's on his way. And I'm just like, how do you know that? I would be second guessing and say, if I don't hear the turkey, he's gone the opposite way or something, but which he might have. There's a lot to be learned, and I think it's almost too nuanced to summarize. And I hope that I have conveyed that in the book adequately, but that's the great part of it. It's just like when you do things right, or when you luck into doing things right, that's when it feels great. But also when things don't go right and you fail, sometimes it stings at the time, but in retrospect, it's almost always a very good feeling of just being out there and having at least absorbed a little bit extra knowledge. You know, you just like, it's just a lifetime spent out there is going to just get you closer to being great at it.
Oh, absolutely, man. I'm fascinated with turkey hunting. I was telling, you know, someone the other day that I've probably killed maybe 14 or 15 turkeys in my life. And really the last year or two, the first time I ever went turkey hunting, I would always just see them opportunistically on one of the ranches, grab the shotgun, you know, and be coming through the house and, you know, kind of run up to the next spot where there'd be a crossing and, you know, I'd get lucky. And then it just happened like that. And then, you know, in Central Texas, there's a field that's pretty bountiful for us. Each year we usually, you know, get one or two, and, you know, sometimes you just kind of walk to the edge of the field and they'll just kind of be there and you're taking a, you know, 50 yard shot and it's just gotten lucky. And then the other year when I started calling them in and really, trying to get my buddy one, that was a game changer. Jesse, I did not understand the infatuation that was about to come with turkey hunting. Like, I mean, it is my favorite type of hunting now. And I love, you know, you and I have talked at length of different, you know, hog hunting adventures and deer and stuff too. But there is something about having that call and response, and also that not knowing, like you were saying too, you don't know if they're coming up, and sometimes all of a sudden it's like, boop, little head pops up. You're like, oh my gosh. Like, I had no idea there was anything even here. And then, you know, it can turn Western real quick, man. It is so exciting. And I had a buddy last year, Colin, he's the other half of Matt, my ranch. And we called one in and it was just past that level of where he was comfortable. But he was like, that was the coolest thing. Cause we actually walked underneath the tree that we thought was a good one. And all of a sudden we heard them all going up. We were underneath the roost tree and we were like, oh, let's step back. Oh,
yeah.
And had no idea. Like, I thought they were in another tree from the night before. Right. And so they had just kind of moved game. And so that was the most exciting thing. And it was, I kind of bring that back to the idea of some of the things of preparing for success. One of the things you mentioned in your book, and you even have a picture too of like a turkey head target that has like the kind of the glow spots, wherever you shoot, you'll see where the BBs are going to hit to see if you get a vital shot. And, you know, you talked about going in and making sure you guys are patterning your gun. Cause my buddy, if he had gone and tested at 50 yards, he would have seen he'd be hitting vitals with his shotgun, but he didn't do that ahead of time. And so he didn't know his distance. And I think that's something that's really important. And I kind of want to talk a little bit to you about your equipment, what you use. I know you talked about a red dot and you're using that. That's something I haven't done. So I'm very curious to pick your brain on, you know, what you think of that versus, you know, just regular iron sights and such. And kind of preparing, like what advice do you give to people so that they can get a turkey in their hands and then be able to utilize your book to kind of explore it further? Maybe some, you know, lessons that you kind of learned throughout your years and what you saw some of these other hunters do as far as preparation. I mean, I assume range time is probably, you know, step one, right?
Certainly. But with the cost of TSS, range time can be real short. You know, yeah. It's like, how much time do you want to spend throwing $15 down range every shot? But I mean, the point must be made that people have killed turkeys with, you know, a standard pump, you know, and number six lead for many, many years, and they've killed them adequately and, you know, and with great skill. I would say, you know, technologically, and I'm not even where close to like a gearhead or I get really excited about this stuff. I usually choose the most functional tool in my price range. Mm-hmm. And so, yeah, I've settled on, I shoot a Gearson semi-auto that I really like a lot. It's just been, you know, you can beat it up pretty good and put a red dot on it. And that was super helpful. And to be very clear, the red dot was given to us, you know? So it's like, I mean, I get it. I want to be very, very transparent about these. It's like, would I have put a red dot on there otherwise? I don't know. Probably. I think I would have eventually. The red dot I put on about halfway through the season. So I actually didn't have it I put it on after the first hunt. And so I do credit that red dot with two of my turkeys that were shot at such awkward angles that I don't know if I could have personally made that shot. And both of them were pretty long shots, over 40, probably over 45 yards on both of them. One of them completely twisted 180 degrees around, the other one at a very awkward uphill angle. With a snow drift above us, and this turkey kind of bobbing around below the crest of this hill. And we had obviously spooked it, but it had stopped long enough. And the red dot allows you to make such a quick acquisition, both eyes full, and wherever, obviously, wherever the red dot is where the boom's going. So that worked out real well for me a couple times. And I just became a real fan of the red dot. Again, you know, shooting TSS, and again, in with the transparency, you know, I got a couple boxes of it for this project. Mm-hmm. And, I think I would save my pennies for it because I firmly believe that it's a very ethical killer too. I mean, it's crazy that a pellet of that size can just zip through a turkey's neck, but you get a few of them on target and that turkey's going to die. And so I feel like it's a very worthwhile piece of equipment. And the thing is, you're not shooting dubs with it, you know? And so it's like a box. I mean, if you are able to pattern it, and then you're in Texas, then you conceivably one box of five will get you through the whole season. And you know, a turkey yields a lot of meat. I'm always approaching things like that. You know, it's $15, you know? Yeah. But you know, get about, it yields about 55% of its body weight. And so it's 20 pounds. And so you're still, you know, you're still looking at a pretty good, shot.
Good ratio.
To,
yeah.
Yeah. Good ratio there. You know, I do like that a lot. I recently bought my daughter, the Stevens single shot, and, those things are really cool. They're very highly rated as turkey guns. They're about 5 or 6 pounds. They're a little bit smaller and they're a single shot. But most of all, they're the MSRP on these things is around $200, and they're very good shotguns. But you know, it's a single shot, but still most of the time you're going to be okay with that. And so that's what I bought that for her, quote unquote. But I also have a strong feeling that in the mountains of New Mexico, I'm going to be lugging that thing around because it is so light and it's a little 20 gauge.
20, I was about to ask. Okay.
So I think, you know, the technology is just so good these days that you're able to get like these little, I mean, even this cheap little single shot and then spend your money on TSS after that, you know? And so, and that's kind of the plan is pop a red dot on that for her. And then, you know, be able to carry that around in the turkey woods. And, you know, another thing I love about it is like, you can really approach it with a very, like a modicum of equipment, you know, a couple calls, whatever calls you're comfortable with. I mean, you can get a vest or not, you know, you can do it with a fanny pack, you know, you probably need a face mask. You need a hat. I think gloves are probably pretty helpful. Mm-hmm. You know, all these things, but you can be highly mobile, you know, just a water bottle and your gun and, you know, a sandwich in your pocket and you can pretty much get after them for a day. And I love that too. It's like, of course you can go overboard with the gear. I mean, anybody, you know, that's into it will, but, I like it because you can kind of get away with, just minimal gear out there.
Yeah, no, it's so true, man. And I've started using some of the TSS, this last year and been pretty pleased with, I didn't get to put a shot on a turkey last year. I was calling them in for friends and just never worked out time-wise, but patterning them, I felt like it was really great grouping. And, you know, some of the stuff that I've even tried before, it's high end. And you know, it was lead, but it was a higher end cost. Things like, you know, $10 a shell. It was shooting like crap for my gun. But then I handed over to my buddy and his was lights out with it. So like, I encourage everybody to, you know, try it, grab a few things off the shelf, see what works best with your rifle. And that goes for hunting, you know, a deer rifle as well. You know, find out exactly what works best with your stuff and give yourself the best chance of success. Cause it could be the, you know, $7 box of Remington. It could be, you know, the TSS stuff. And, you know, I definitely think there's a lot to that, and that technology has come a long way from, you know, what I grew up with. So I think, you know, there's like two on the shelf when I was, you know, a kid. Yeah. Get this one or that one. So we definitely have tried a bunch of them out, but it's fun to see those. And those shoot and see targets too. You can get them with the turkey head on and see kind of what your success will be at different ranges. So I highly suggest that. You know, when we're talking about different turkeys, obviously, you know, let's see, we got Rio Grande in Texas, the Eastern, you need the Miriam when you were over there in Oregon. The, I guess the last one in your turkey slam would be, it's the, what's it called? The
Osceola.
Osceola. Have you had one yet? And that's mainly in like Florida, right?
Right. I believe there's five counties in Florida. We were in southeastern Georgia. So we were, you know, close by. I mean, we're still hours from the range of the Osceola. And initially I had considered trying to do that. But then I realized I didn't want to just portray a slam, because also with the Osceola, if you're not able to draw public there, which is available, you have to put in some years of putting in, but you can draw that. But then otherwise, it's fairly walled off and pretty expensive to do that. And so I didn't really want to represent like some sort of just going out there for this slam.
Yeah.
But I did want to represent the topography. So that's why we chose southeastern Georgia, and we were hunting palmetto swamps, and pine flats and savannas and stuff like that. So fairly similar to the range of the Osceola, which is kind of a, if I remember correctly, it's kind of like a sub variant of the Eastern. Mm-hmm. They share a lot of qualities, and we were hunting Easterns there. Definitely Rio Grande in Texas. In Oregon, hard to say the buff side, but if it was a Rio, it was a little on the white side. So it might have been a hybrid. It was definitely a mountain bird. And everybody I was with is like Miriam's, but if you look at a map, it's debatable what it was. But it definitely, you know, it was a situation where I was hunting in a place, in a circumstance that was so far different than anything I ever had. You know, like we were in 3 foot deep snow and hunting these and mountain birds. You know, there's like a running stream, you know, full of runoff, melting snow, and then pines, and there's mallards flying around, and, you know, just a total situation like that. So if not a Miriam's, then a Miriam's situation.
Yeah. And well, I mean, you in that situation there too, you ended up, you know, I think you were saying, I forgot if it was Kevin or Ben who was like, don't forget, you need to get some snowshoes, right? And there you're like, wait, huh?
Yeah. Yeah. It was, I mean, when checking in before we flew out for the hunt, he gave us a weather update. And I mean, it was 17 degrees in the morning, one morning when we were out there hunting, and it was snowing overnight. So we'd walk out and there was like a fresh layer of snow. Spring came late that year, and it made the hunting, it was very, very difficult because we just couldn't go anywhere. It was not only snow, but it had a kind of an ice pack on top. And so every time you took a step, it was just the loudest thing, way louder than leaves, you know, dead leaves. It was just very, very loud. A very difficult hunt, but I did still manage to get a bird on the first morning. Yep. I mean, through what we walked up on one, and didn't shoot that one, but we're in the process of calling that one in a little satellite, not a little, but a satellite gobbler, I guess a subdominant bird. I was like, this is my chance. See, here I go again. I think he saw his chance, and he never gobbled, but we could hear him drumming above us, and it was hard to tell where all these sounds were coming from. We're in this kind of canyon with a lot of running water, one very loud gobbler down the road kind of talking to us, but at the same time I kept being like, is there's a gobbler drumming right above us, and I mean like right above us. And it turns out there was, but it was a very awkward climb. We had to like kind of, you know, find good footing and then be able to stick our heads up just to even see. We're on a very steep, probably steeper than 45 degree angle, slope at this point, kind of wedged behind some trees. And it was, I think it was probably 10 to 15 yards from us up this slope. And, you know, finally, when I was able to lay eyes on it, it was obviously able to lay eyes on me at the same time. And that's when it was like, okay, I got to seal the deal on this thing. And so made it work, you know, and got a very beautiful bird on that first morning. But yeah, it was just a lot of different regions. And I think that was kind of our approach, you know, wanted to delve into the subspecies, but really I think that, like, you know, to the point in Oregon, it's like they've reestablished and stocked turkeys there, and they stocked Rios there. And, you know, a turkey's going to act like a mountain turkey. You know, a turkey's going to act like a mesquite flat turkey. A turkey's going to act like a swamp turkey. So, you know, I could be very wrong in this, but I don't know if the subspecies have different, you know, intellectual qualities, or if they're more wily. It very well might be, but I think that it's mostly determined by their surroundings and their day-to-day predator interactions, the hunting pressure and things like that. And so when we approached it geographically, I wanted to really just reflect on these different places that were so different, and they had different trees, you know. So there's like what, you know, mostly scrubby small trees, you know, interlaced with a few taller cottonwoods of oaks would be like, that's Texas. Mm-hmm. Versus, you know, these pine flats out in Georgia versus these pine forests, which are totally different in the Pacific Northwest and the Rockies. And then you go into this old world forest of Connecticut, where it's just these hardwoods, and it's exactly what you think it's going to be like up there. It's just, you know, Pilgrim City, you know, and it's just like the New England, you know, and it's just picture perfect and just gorgeous woods up there. And so I think that we chose these spots to give it a diversity of environment.
Well, it does that. And I think it paints it out really well and kind of gives you, you know, each one calls for a different circumstance on, you know, how you're going to hunt, obviously in the snow versus, you know, someplace in Texas where, you know, sometimes we might be sitting there in 90 degrees, 90% humidity, waiting on a turkey in the morning. And so you look at that versus 19 degrees or whatever, you know, 9 day difference there. And, you know, like you said, too, all those elements that come into how you approach and what's the pressure looking like, what's it like, are there other hunters, is there other calling? And, you know, there's so much. And like you said, it's very nuanced. I was, you know, when you were talking about that, I was thinking about like Connecticut and like all the rock walls and stuff, and like going in, cause you're hunting in a lot of those places. In a very, like, there's a lot of folks' houses around. I mean, there's private lands that you got access to, but you have to be, you know, very mindful of boundaries, you know, anywhere you are. But there's a, you know, it can be dangerous, because, I mean, I used to live in Western Massachusetts. I lived in Boston, and I know there's parts where you're just driving through in the town, and there's just a bunch of turkeys going through someone's yard, you know, and there may be someone who's at the end of that, you know, at a park or something that's going to be hunting those, but it's tight quarters and there's a lot of people. It's a whole different environment than, you know, the wide open expanse and things too. So I know, like in your book, it was kind of brought me back to those, you know, days of driving around those areas when I lived there, and kind of I could really get a sense of that. And yes, how there is a lot of times there's a lot of farmland and stuff there too, obviously, but you know, there's some spots where you have to be, it's a little pocket that you're hunting. You kind of, y'all had that too. There's houses around and you could hear the road traffic, and you know, probably maybe help you guys as you're going through. And then I loved how you guys came around, and there's a part in the book where you guys come back through a rock wall and you're standing there and like, you're being super quiet, and you turn to your hunting partner, and you know, you said, like, probably wasn't the best question for me to lead with, but I was like, why does it smell so damn good? Yeah. What was it that was cut down there? Some kind of olive tree or something?
Well, yeah, not like an olive, right, producing olive, but it was called autumn olive. And it was just like it just smelled incredible. And like, as soon as we couldn't speak, because we had roosted this bird and we got in really tight on it. And the whole morning I'm just sitting there like can't wait to ask the guy, I'm like, why does it smell so good right here? And finally, you know, we had the opportunity, you know, it's like there's some traffic noise, or I think actually the bird had just bailed on us finally, and I'm like, okay, go ahead and ask this question now. I think that all these places, and we didn't really realize this until after the fact, but gave us a really great snapshot of where you can hunt turkeys and how different these situations can be. Rather, you know, like I was saying, you know, it can be the mountains, it can be swamps, it can be. We started off on a vast private ranch in Texas, you know, and some people are gonna be like, well, that's, you know, and I'm like, well, yeah, but I got access to it. So I'm going, and we've worked hard. Yeah. We've worked hard to maintain a good turkey population there, to create one actually, which we discuss in the book is like what we've done to try to improve the population there. And then winding up in Connecticut, where, like you said, it's just like, there's these rock walls that just are, you know, sequester this little plot and this plot. And it's very, very different. I mean, the whole mindset of, you know, filling out permission slips and lots of private land, little private areas, and also lots of public land. And so we were, you know, within a day, we've from public land and then go on, right on to private land that we had permission to go on, you know, things like that. So it was really interesting. And at the end of the day, I'm so thankful that we got to experience that, because what I wanted to is be able to speak to as many turkey hunters as possible, you know, and from my perspective as a relative novice to it and someone that loves it, but just to be able to go out there and have the experiences, hopefully, that just some of them have, you know, whereas like, oh, I hunt public land in New England, or I hunt, you know, in palmetto swamps, or, you know, if you hunt in Texas, you pretty much have to hunt on private land for turkey. I mean, there's hardly any opportunities for public here at all. Or in the mountains for that matter, you know, it's like it, and just really wanted to be able to speak to everyone through that. And at the end of it, it was like, oh, we kind of got that, you know, we got such a great diversity of experiences.
No, you really did, in all the different regions. I think there's some universal things within any kind of turkey hunting, regardless of the region, right? I mean, there's this unpredictability, there's different things that you learn too. Like, there's obviously that dominant bird, and then like the satellite birds. There's a lot of things you talk to that I think paints a picture too for someone who may be just getting into it, because there's a lot of folks who, you know, are coming into the outdoor world that haven't before, or maybe they're picking back up. And so I think it's cool. It kind of gives you that, the language of what it is that, you know, maybe more advanced turkey hunters than myself, at least, are talking about and saying, hey, this might be why this happened, and just things to consider, because there is, you know, there's nuances with every hunt, but I think that there are, there's a lot of different things to think about. And, you know, there are areas too, like, you know, in our family ranch in South Texas in Dimmit County there, we used to have a lot of turkeys, and now there's like, there's none, man. I got a Jake a couple seasons back, and I had seen him on camera. I hadn't seen any other birds there. And it's something that I'm now, my approach isn't like, oh, there's a turkey, I'm going to get it. Like, now this year, I was like, you know what? If there's a turkey or a few turkeys, maybe we just watch them, you know, photograph and video them. Because if there's a lack of them in that area, we might want to back up and not try to, you know, just put some in the freezer, and think about being able to maybe then repeatedly put some in the freezer in years to come. Because there are areas, you talked about it when you guys were in Georgia there with your buddy too, like, y'all were talking about making sure you're taking the right bird, and there's a reason too. So I think each area people need to maybe kind of have that, you know, awareness. If there's a plethora of turkeys, and, you know, maybe by all means take whatever one, but maybe you want to have a dominant bird that's breeding more often, because you might need those numbers. And maybe those other ones are fighting and they're not breeding as much because they're battling each other, and you got to be cognizant of those things. So that was something that was kind of fun to read and kind of take that next, like, aha moment, like, oh yeah, that's something I need to consider a little bit more. Kind of made me think a little bit more along the lines of not only just consumption, but, you know, conservation as a whole and what you can do. And I mean, you kind of nod to, you know, Turkey Federation, and, you know, there's a, you know, Tom Kelly, which, is that correct? I think I read in the book you guys had the same birthday as well. Is that?
Yeah, that's right.
That's
yeah.
Really cool, man. That's fun.
Yeah, no, absolutely. I think that, you know, especially after coming off of writing a book about feral hogs, which is, I mean, basically the approach to them is kill them all, you know, young and old. Like, and to go from something that has an exploding invasive population to something that in some places is thriving, but in a lot of places is not, and to encourage their consumption, which is what I'm doing. You know, I'm like, yeah, get out there and hunt them and let's eat them. But it has to be done in a much more mindful way, just like you said. And I think that, you know, there are some of the most incredible and dedicated conservation groups out there, NWTF, for example. I mean, just boots on the ground, action, habitat, and improvement. And then also disseminating the information to, you know, people that are either involved in public land hunting or private land hunting on how to do habitat improvement, which is, in my perspective, like probably the best thing for turkeys is to, how do you improve their habitat? Do you open up an area, or how do you honestly just control predation, you know, if that's what's really taking them out. And so I think NWTF provides an incredible resource for that. And they've got a lot of people behind. I mean, they're just, their membership alone is just incredible. And it speaks to, their mission and their success too. And in revitalizing this incredible bird to huntable populations, which, you know, is the thing the non-hunter never understands. It's just like, oh, you want to kill them all? No, that's not at all what we're saying, you know? And in fact, when was the last time you did anything to help a wild turkey? And the answer is usually never, whereas you've got this incredible organization, or many organizations, but especially NWTF, that's out there and helping it along. And I think it's just, turkey should be an indelible part of our landscape always, you know, and it's something that we should really strive for. And if you can get out there and put a couple of them in your freezer and then watch a few dozen more, then you've really succeeded.
Yeah, no, for sure. And I think it bears mentioning, like, the idea too, if people are out there and they're private landowners, you know, reaching out to your NRCS agent, talking to local people about what you can maybe do. Like on our property, we took out a bunch of invasive, you know, trees, these non-indigenous brush and stuff. And we ended up planting a bunch of natural grasses and forbs that were native to that area in Central Texas, and worked with the seed company, and they recommend it. And there's funding available to do that. And one of the goals that we had was to be able to have some of these 3 to 6 acre fields that we could be able to have these higher grasses. They're better for turkeys for whenever they're having their young. It also helps for fawns and things too, where maybe they can be able to reach out past that time of when, you know, predation can be the highest number, and they can kind of, you know, live and, you know, yeah, kind of give them that safety, and also places for them to be able to just go through and have, you know, just better habitat overall. So I think it's something too that, you know, with all animals, there's something that you can get from your NRCS agent, and there's a lot of resources that's out there. So if you're looking to, you know, improve that habitat, because I mean, you know, you and I know this, but maybe some of the listeners might not. There's a lot of areas that didn't have turkeys before that some of these organizations came through and repopulated them because they were hunted down to, you know, very dangerously low numbers, or there's counties that were eradicated fully and now have them again. So I think that's something too that, that relocation, of, you know, these areas that were being repopulated because they once were they were flourishing, right? They were thriving. Mm-hmm. And then they went to no numbers, and especially with deer too, there's a lot of different areas that I think people don't understand that. And I was just wanted to also mention too, when you're talking about like that conservation too, and these other organizations, you know, us as hunters, anytime you're buying equipment, anytime you're buying ammo, you're buying your license, you know, there's a lot of money that goes back into the conservation funds for this. You know, I mean, hunters, anglers, target hunters, you know, or shooters, you know, that a lot of those, you know, a lot of those funds go back with the Pittman Robertson or Robertson Pittman. I say it backwards every time, so I said it both. One of those is correct. But that's something that really, you know, our taxes get back more than anyone else. So I think those same people who might be like, oh, y'all are just trying to kill them, it's like, part of the reason some of these are there is because there is people that want to hunt them and utilize them and know where their meat comes from, which I think is super important. Along those lines too, you mentioned something in the book where you talk about if someone has the ability for 5 to 7 days to kind of, you know, keep your turkey in a very cool, dry space, that before you go ahead and vacuum seal it and throw it into the freezer, that will help with the firmness. And, you know, if you said, oh, if you don't do that, it won't have too much of a negative effect. Can you maybe talk to that idea of like what you may see a difference of if you are kind of, I guess, aging it, you know, before you freeze it for those days? And like what, because I'm I can have some assumptions in my mind, but I don't know if they'd be right. So I'd like for you to kind of address that, and maybe what are those differences between going through that process and maybe not? Is there a real discernible difference to you?
Sure, there is. And I think that, like, you know, I get this question a lot about processing, you know, breaking down animals, getting them cold, and when to start the butchering process after that. And often in context of deer and hogs and turkeys, ducks, everything. Mm-hmm. And I think my first overarching answer is to do it when you're able, you know, and not beat yourself up about like, oh no, I need to let this animal chill for X number of days before I can effectively do it. And so a lot of times, I mean, for me, you know, like I might break a hog down because there's a cold front the day after, you know, it's just like, but it's going to warm back up into the 70s. But if I can comfortably sit outside in the 40s, you know, on my porch and have basically an outdoor refrigerator while I'm breaking an animal down, I'm going to take that route. And so, and that completely undoes all those things I'm saying, like, oh, you know, for a hog, you know, 8 days is great, you know, but you know, if it's going to be cold after 2 days, 2 days is also great, you know.
Yeah.
Turkey's the same way. I think that, again, I'm going to restate what I always say and just like keep animals cold and dry. Cold and dry, not cold and wet, you know, cold and as dry as possible. However you can achieve that, under 40 and as dry as possible until you start cutting on it. So I mean, hanging it in a walk-in, sure, that's great. You know, in a cooler where it's not in direct contact with ice. And that goes for pigs and deer as well, which is very contentious. But I do think that with turkeys, you do experience this kind of flop with them where they're very fresh. It might affect their tenderness a little bit, or it probably will. I mean, usually if you eat something where it's super fresh, it's not going to be as tender. You know, that goes for a deer or a hog. Mm-hmm. If you let any of these animals kind of age for, you know, and chill for a few days, they will start to kind of relax, become more tender. I think, yes. I mean, a turkey will start to firm up very nicely after 3, 4, 5 days if kept nice and cold and dry. And you might not experience so much of that wobble that they can have. But it's not a hill I want to die on at all, because they're just objectively delicious birds, and there might be a nominal amount of more of like chewiness to it, but not even in a bad way, from not quote unquote aging it or letting it chill for that long. So really, I'm more in the camp, and my whole goal is to encourage people to process their entire animal and cook it and enjoy it further. And so last thing I want to do is go in and add all these stipulations or make it harder or guilt people about or overcomplicate it or cause any self-doubt there. So really, I think for me, it's imperative that we just attach some very simple rules, cold and dry, mm-hmm. and then at your earliest or at your convenience after that, not necessarily your earliest, but just at your convenience after that, get in there and try to process that animal. Enjoy the processing, like enjoy this time spent with the animal afterwards. It's just kind of a new campaign. I'm just like, I think that we're hyper focused on the fun stops, you know, either when you take the shot or when you walk up to the animal and then you're like, oh hell, now all the work starts. It's like, I'm like, a whole new array of work starts now that is also highly enjoyable to me. And I think if we can realign our wants, like what we're looking for out of this whole process, embracing the plucking of the bird or the eviscerating or the breaking it down, the packaging, you know, you can spend time with a friend or a loved one and package and, you know, like, oh, you're on labels. Oh, hey, you did a great job vac sealing that with the kids, you know,
yeah.
And get in the freezer and then the enjoyment of cooking it. If we can just realign to enjoying the entire spectrum, this is a very broad answer to a very specific question, by the way. I'm sorry.
No, man, this is good. I like where you're going.
But I think that, yeah, instead of bogging down a little bit in specifics, is just kind of embrace some just rough general guidelines that will improve game, you know, like keeping things dry and cold for a while and trusting your nose. You know, I had a client recently who's like, is this deer aged too long? I'm like, you'll know, like you'll know, like your brain is hardwired to tell you when deer is not good to eat anymore, you know? And until that point, I'm pretty sure that it's going to be fine. So I think that, yeah, like I said, realigning what we want out of the process and trying to enjoy it more and just taking it day by day and just saying, oh, hey, I've hung the turkey or I've kept it in the cooler nice and dry. It's only been 3 days, but you know, I got to get to work in 3 hours. I'm going to go ahead and just bust it down, back seal it and put it in the freezer. And then if you were to tell me that that was your plan, I'd be like, that's great. That's great. I really, yeah, you did not do anything wrong. That's exactly how it should be done. And I hope that all those dishes come out beautifully and your family's happy.
No, it's very important. I'm glad you touched upon that. Cause I think, you know, there's a lot of people who will like that idea that work begins. Like for my buddy, like Matthew Mitchell and I, who hunt together a lot and he's quite a cook. Like that's where another level of the fun begins. I mean, look at it work. It's like, yes, there's things you have to do in the time and, you know, you got to move along. If it's hot, you got to kind of get to that animal as quick as you can, cool it down and dry as quick as you can, but that's fun. And then, you know, you're thinking about like, we're always butchering stuff up and like, okay, that's going to go for that meal. This is going to be how we're going to cook this. Oh man, that cool new recipe from the turkey book. We're going to try that out. Okay. Like there's different things when you're looking at that meat and figuring out what you're going to do with it that I think is just as important. And like, I think, can't remember if we talked about it last time you were on, or if maybe I just heard you talk about it before and maybe a post, but like for those who like, you know, it's like you go out to like the Dove Lease, right? You drive 4 hours, you go, you know, shoot your limit in 30 minutes. And then why not spend half that time of driving you did to be able to take, you know, defeather and pluck these birds. And like the amount of time we spend and the money we spend leading up to that, we should enjoy the process of preparing our foods for our family and our friends just as much. And I think it's one of those things we have to have that time spent in honoring that animal and that time of what you're going to do with it later on, all the preparation instead of just kind of quickly throwing it down and, you know, getting in the freezer or whatever. I think anything you can do to prepare it where it's going to be the tasting the best, having the most experience. But I find it to just be super fun when breaking down. So I wasn't always that way. I've definitely gained the knowledge, you know, and I think that's for people who are listening who are maybe are coming in the first time hunting, you know, maybe, you know, particular animals, something like the hog book, the turkey book is going to be very valuable for them to learn about butchering. You know, you guys in the book, you talk about, you know, plucking, and then, you know, cutting out and skinning too. So you're kind of leading people along whatever path they want to choose in their adventure. And I really love, man, again, the photography is just second to none, man. You know, Jody and Sam did such an amazing job with all those. It's really a work of art, man. I'm so stoked for you, man. I mean, I can't wait to get it in my hands, and I'm sure you as well, right?
Yeah. We can't wait to get it out there. It was an incredible experience to be able to hang out with all these people and put it together. And again, I just like, I love it, you know, and I hope that it shows, you know, I have a lot of enthusiasm for it. And I grew to love these birds, you know, and I grew to love them from the way I normally grow to love something is I love to eat them. Like I just absolutely love eating turkey. Like on my birthday, which happens, you know, it's Tom Kelly's birthday, Colonel Tom, is, you know, kind of at the tail end of turkey season. So with any luck around my birthday every year, I'm going to have some turkey breast and I'm going to have some dewberries. And it's like those two things for me represent like probably my favorite meal. And it's not something extreme or fancy. It's like, well, I love fried turkey with gravy and mashed potatoes, probably some greens, but we can do green beans that time of year too. That's perfectly fine. And then a dewberry cobbler. And like, to me, that's just like, that's what I want to eat. And so like coming at it from that direction. And then I was like, oh, well, and they're also like probably the most enthralling hunt that I've ever been on. And a really good excuse to be out in the spring, no less, you know, yeah. At the most, you know, arguably the most beautiful time of year, especially here in Texas, just everything is just exploding. the birds are, you know, just like all the bird life is talking, you know, thing is just growing. It's verdant. It's just like, it's so beautiful. And it's so wonderful to be out that time of year. And like what, you know, we're so lucky to be able to experience things like this. And yeah, I just hope that, you know, the enthusiasm is conveyed for that. And, you know, like plucking a bird with friends or, you know, standing around it, cause you've got the time, come on, you've got the time.
Yeah,
you know, it's like to say that, you know, like, oh, it takes too long to pluck these doves. It's like, listen, yeah, like you said, listen, there's a 4-hour drive out here or even a 1-hour drive, you know, it's like, time spent in the car you're not going to convince me is any better than time plucking a dove. Like, right. I mean, come on. Cause you can still listen to your podcast, you know, you can still listen to some music. You can legally drink a beer.
Yes. Yes. There you go.
You're allowed to have an open container while plucking doves. And so, I mean, I don't know what more argument I need.
That's really the foundational one right there from here on out. I'm not going to drive anymore. I'm just going to drink some beers in the field, pluck dogs,
there
man.
Go. There you go.
Well, you talked about like that being your birthday meal and your death row meal for fried wild turkey. I was actually going to ask you too, if for some reason wild turkey is not available, what is your second or third go-to meal for birthday or the death row meal? What is it that you're like, man, I'm preparing this if that isn't available?
Crab cakes, blue crab. 100%. So yeah, blue crab, you know, we just pulled the traps. We got, you know, 16 big old male, what they call whales, you know, just like those like 1-pounders blue crabs. I'm going to boil those, chill them. We're going to pick that meat and I'm going to make the biggest batch of crab cakes ever in a salad. I like crab cakes with a salad. And some sort of like homemade mayonnaise is flavored probably with basil or some other, herb and, a lot of white wine. Technically that could be the first course before the fried turkey.
If it's your birthday or your last meal, you get to choose these things.
Yeah. Man. Yeah. So I'd go crab cakes. Definitely. 100%. I love crab cakes.
Yeah. Well, now, if it was a big game animal, what would you go for?
I would do axes. I would probably eat raw axes, probably tartar, you know, just a classic tartar preparation, you know, just diced, probably backstrap axes deer, you know, a little mustard, a little shallot, maybe a little raw onion in there, a nice, beautiful, egg yolk from a very reputable farm on top of that and a side of fries.
Nice. Yeah. Nice.
We'll play this game all day long.
Yeah. No, I mean, there's a certain point we're going to get so hungry, we're going to have to retreat to kitchens, but I was very curious about that. Cause I think fried wild turkey is one of the best ways to give an introduction to people who are hunting and especially like kids. And I mean, even in your book there, you have some pictures of you and your daughter, like, you know, preparing those and stuff too, which is really cool. I like seeing that and, you know, hearing about you talking to her and how you're like, this is all for hopefully something that we'll share together. And, I can echo that statement too, with, you know, hoping that, you know, my little one, and I appreciate your throw out on that idea, that the single shot too, cause I'm letting my younger one move from a 410 on up. So, that'll be valuable as well to check out, but doing something there together with family. And like, I've done fried turkey and I've done like turkey cordon bleu for folks too. And I mean, anytime you're throwing a bunch of prosciutto or bacon or just, you know, all sorts of really amazing cheeses, I feel like it kind of hides the wild turkey though a little bit. It's a great tasting dish and there's a lot of things I've done with it, but I think it masks it a little bit. So I'm always looking for different things that would be kind of okay, here's the second meal to show you guys what this can feature. And there's so many amazing ones in there. You know, I think it's really important too, that if for those who didn't know, like turkey legs, a lot of folks I've known before, like, well, I don't keep them, or I've heard them say that. And people that I hunt with keep them always because they're delicious. You just have to maybe do a little bit of different preparation. And I know that this maybe mundane for you to talk about a little bit, but can you maybe address the idea of what you're doing with turkey legs, and what are some of the things that people need to know and why you need to keep them?
Oh, 100%. I mean, I love that question. And I mean, I was being very kind earlier about, you know, like, oh, don't be hard on yourself about this and that. But if you're not saving your turkey legs, I think you should be hard on yourself. I'm sorry. Like, that's probably about 45% of the usable bird right there. And if you've had a bad experience with turkey legs, it's because you didn't cook them long enough. Done. Period. And they more than likely need to be cooked in some sort of liquid. I think the crock pot is bar none the best way to do that. In fact, for dinner, not tonight, but tomorrow, I'm making a tortilla soup from the turkey book. And awesome. I just had a leg in the crock pot. But it took a long time to cook. I mean, I let it roll overnight. And so we're probably talking about maybe start to finish 10 hours. And you do need to allow it to have a lot of time. At the end of that, though, what I have is a lot of broth and a lot of shredded meat, which gives me multiple opportunities to, or recipes that I can apply that towards. So in this case, I chose the tortilla soup. But I try to put this in the books a lot, where like you can do a method that will like yield broth and shredded meat. And then here's 1, 2, 3, 4, 5, 6, maybe more recipes that you can use with said shredded meat. And then you also have this beautiful stock that you've made, you know, and it's like, it's better than water. I mean, in fact, it's very good. It's nutrient dense. It's delicious. You can either use that in the recipe, or you can substitute that where somebody's saying, oh, you need to use chicken stock. It's like, why would you do that? You just made turkey stock.
Yeah.
And a leg yields a surprising amount. People are like, oh, but the tendons. I'm like, listen, like they will just, you just pick them right out. It's so easy. They're the hard white pieces. Remove them. It's so easy. I think that the legs absolutely have to be kept. If I was in charge, it would be a law. But also how interesting it is, like how different the legs and breasts are on a turkey. I mean, the breast is a highly approachable white meat. Like you were saying, it's a wonderful introduction to people who may be leery about game. You're like, no, here, try this wild turkey, where it's just like, it's recognizable, but it still has enough of a flavor of a singular, unique flavor that is that of wild turkey and only wild turkey, that they can recognize, while at the same time being completely, you know, in the realm of everyday food. They're like, oh, this is easy. I mean, like if they're like, I would never eat wild game. I mean, then they're eating like, yes, of course, this is great. You know? But then the legs represent something totally different. They're very dark. They're very rich. And they can be tough. I mean, if you think about that animal, it ran around all day, you know, it's an athlete. Those legs versus the amount that it uses its breast to power its wings. They need to be cooked for a very long time. And it just really requires some planning more than anything else. And I think that's where people might get tied up, is that they pull out a turkey leg and they want in the afternoon, and they're like, let's have this for dinner. It's like, no, I mean, tomorrow.
Yeah.
Maybe, but not tonight, or the fall, you know? Yeah. And it's so simple to take that, you know, cut an onion in half, throw a bay leaf in there, cover it with water, put it on low, wake up in the morning to this delicious smell, and then go from there. But absolutely keep the legs. I love the heart, liver, gizzard, because it represents such a good volume, and they're also very mildly flavored for those organs. You know, like, I mean, venison liver, for instance, pretty strong.
Yeah.
Turkey liver, however, pretty mild and very, very good for making things like boudin or pâtés and things like that. And so it's very simple. It's also large and it yields a good amount. I mean, there's whole dishes that you can make with the heart, liver, gizzard that probably feed 4 people if you stretched it appropriately. And I just love tricks like that. But speaking of the legs specifically, I really feel like it's not hard to remove them, especially if you're skinning. You don't have to pluck. If that's not your desired outcome, is to have the skin on there. And so they're real easy to skin and just break them off. And you're almost doubling your take-home yield from that hunt. And they're very enjoyable.
Oh, I learned the hard way by not cooking it long enough. And it was something that I was like, I probably needed to double that time. And I forgot I did some kind of Pasole. And did you have one that was like a Verde in the Afield book? Was it? There was a
crab, Pasole.
Okay. Yeah. Gotcha. I just recalled reading about that. I forgot where I had found this one, but a bunch of hominy, and it was just a wonderful soup that I made. And I tried one with red wine too another time, just to really seeing different ways to break it down and just sampling. And I think that's part of the fun too, is you have something like an open playbook and you look at, you know, the turkey book and you can just see all the different ways you can try. Like you said, there may be like four or five different ways you can try to do this. Once you've had this, you break it down, different broths you can reuse. There's so many different ways to utilize that and try things out and figure out what you and your family like and, you know, go from there. And it's, you know, I'm always happy when I get one turkey in the freezer. But this is like, this book has made me, it's reinvigorated something with me, Jesse. Like I want to take it to that nth degree and make sure that I can fill the freezer with more. You know, like as we've talked about before, my place in Central Texas, it's a one turkey town, right? I mean, that's what you get in South Texas. You know, you can have up to four a year, but out there it's being kind of really run down as far as the turkey hunting's going. So, you know, I'm definitely looking to expand things out and, you know, talk to some other friends, maybe trade some hunts, because I really want to cook more with wild turkey. It's something that I find to be one of my favorite things to work with, next to hogs. And 10 years ago, you would have never heard that statement out of my mouth. Like it was all about deer and, you know, if someone brought some elk around, but, I'm really enjoying that and getting into small game a lot too. So I'm really just super excited to hopefully get something on the ground this year. And I think I got like one leg and one breast left. And I was actually curious too, because I have some sandhill crane. Is there some of the things that are in the turkey book that you would maybe say, hey, you could also try this with sandhill crane? Is there any that are kind of, you know, replaceable in there that you would maybe point someone in the direction to if they had some sandhill crane around?
The legs would probably be fairly similar, and mm-hmm. that it's going to take a long time to braise them out. So yeah, I think so. The breasts, you know, on a sandhill, I always think, you know, just like highest and best use of breasts is to kind of cook them like a steak, you know, yep. medium rare, which is not what you would do with turkey.
Right.
So I think the breasts are going to kind of pose like a bit of a different species, you know, or a bit of a different situation, you know, and where I probably wouldn't, but the legs, yes, I would. I mean, I think that's the short answer.
Yeah, no, that's great, man. You know, I got to thinking too, you've got the hog book, you've got the turkey book. And so I have to ask, will we one day see the crappy book? Because the name alone warrants a book, you know? I'll order the first 10 copies right now, man. I'll get the ball rolling.
Yeah. I mean, I did cover crappie in a field a bit. And it is something that is very near and dear to my heart. And also poses a real existential crisis to me. I am proud non-boat owner. I have a canoe and a kayak, you know, but for the most part I have no motorized boats in my arsenal, and so my crappie fishing is very much confined to the spring, along with my other favorite, which is the white bass. And I'm really running into a real problem in that turkey season, white bass season, and crappie season are all kind of happening at the same time, and I don't know how to like break up my time in order to address all of those, especially crappie and turkeys, because a white bass run a little bit earlier, you know, you can kind of get like February, early March on those, but everything, the crappie and the turkeys, are a little too concurrent, for me. And so I'm in my second season of really dealing with this, terrible, personal issue. And so I'm trying to figure it out this year. Also, I get hyper focused, and it's like while I'm, you know, in turkey brain, I can't go fish for crappie. Like,
yeah,
and it's hard for me to bounce back and forth between them. But I think this year I'm gonna have to man up a bit and figure out how to make that so, and go and do both.
Well, and it's not like you have anything else going on. You know, for those who are maybe not fully familiar with the scope of your work and projects, Let's go ahead and just give a real brief description of what you got going on with Daidu and New School Traditional Cookery, if you don't mind. Just spend a short time. So we talked about it in the last podcast. I'll put the links down below. You can learn a little bit more. But for those who may be new listeners, maybe just to go ahead and give them a little glimpse of that.
Yeah. So Daidu is my restaurant. I'm fortunate enough where we have a very talented chef who runs the day-to-day, but I'm there quite a bit. I'm about to head up there in a little while. You know, it's in the east side of Austin. Been there. We'll be at 10 years. We'll have our 10-year anniversary this August.
Congrats.
Yeah. It's a long time for a restaurant.
Yeah. You know,
especially in the past few years. It's a tough life. But yeah, so we have a restaurant. It's a very locally focused restaurant. We serve you know, lemons only when they're in season. Our tea, I'm sure you're familiar with Yopon. Our iced tea is made out of Yopon. All the meats and seafood, seafood all comes out of the Gulf. All the meats are locally sourced. All of our dairy, all of our vegetables. It's a fun place to eat. It's fairly meat focused and a lot of stuff grilled over oak. We do a lot of butchery in house and pretty much make everything from scratch. I like it a lot. And then we also have the New School of Traditional Cookery, which is the educational branch of that. I do start to finish hunting, butchery, and cookery classes, mostly hog and deer focused. Obviously, trying to branch out a little bit. We've done a lot of fishing in the past, but trying to create a more robust program. But usually this time of year or during hunting season, I'm down there quite a bit. We do these 4-day classes, starting with sighting in all the way through packaging of flying. But those are very popular. It's very hard to keep up. And I would love to, in the next couple of years, start to develop a plan that could accommodate more people. Because I think we'd have so much demand and it's hard to reach everybody. And I love the educational aspect of it. So I love teaching butchery classes and cooking and talking about stuff like that and just helping people along with, you know, just getting more confidence and empowerment as far as breaking down animals and utilizing them to their potential. So NSTC does that for us. And then, yeah, so now 3 books in. I never saw that coming, but the hog book and the turkey book are both available through our, we're self-published. Jody handles that and who's the photographer / publisher. So they're now available under an umbrella called the Wild Books, and that's thewildbooks.com. And the turkey book and hog book are both available through there.
And then Bezos has a field if you guys need that, right?
Yeah, Jeff will sell you one of those. Yeah, that's the best way to get it. Oh, we have them at the restaurant too. Yeah. If you want to avoid Jeff, but yeah, he'll sell you one, no problem.
And then pre-orders are available right now at thewildbooks.com. That's, you have turkey book. You're going to have some that are signed too. And correct. Is that last time you had some with you and Jody? Is Sam going to get in on the signature side of things there too? How are you going to?
Honestly, I don't think so, because Sam is in Bozeman. And so I think the shipping conundrum that we would have,
yes.
or we'd have to fly him down here just to wear his hand out, sign the books. Sam was imperative in the creation of these books, though, and so highly appreciated. We're also very excited because we're going to have a bundle with NWTF where you can get a membership, a year membership to NWTF and a book at $10 off each of those. So a $20 savings total for those. So you can get a book and a membership. If you're already a member, then it will automatically tag on a year from the date of purchase of your membership with NWTF, and you get a really good savings out of that. So we're really excited to offer that as well.
That's great, man. You know, I know you've worked with a bunch of different organizations. Are there some other ones that you're kind of, you know, doing some work with now? I mean, I don't want to spill any projects if there's anything coming out, but just some other ones that you kind of near and dear to your heart that you might want to just kind of give a shout out to, or think, you know, maybe people should take a look at, you know, and obviously they're huge in the turkey world, but are there some other ones that you kind of would say, hey guys, you should check this one out as well?
Certainly. I mean, I, My friend Graham Jones, he always puts it best. He says there's a lot of room in the sandbox for everybody. And, you know, here in Texas, and we usually are trying to just work on a more local level. I mean, I feel like I can get a lot more done, you know, in Texas than a more broader scope. So we work a lot with, you know, my two favorite organizations here are, one of them is a private lands advocacy group and one is a public lands advocacy group. And I love working with them both, and I love how they get along in this state, because we're all on the same team here, and that'd be the Texas Wildlife Association and also Backcountry Hunters and Anglers. There's not that many public opportunities in Texas, but they still get out there and represent, and then mostly focus on conservation at this point, which is great. And there's never any need or any end in need,
right,
for conservation focuses these days. And so, and then also TWA, which advocates for private land, and helping landowners just get the max usage out of that, and then how to conserve on their land and how to improve the stewardship of that. And they also bring a lot of new hunters out to these private lands through their adult learn to hunt program, which I am a huge fan of. I think it is an exemplary program and should be copied by the lesser states.
Yeah.
you know, it is a really incredible program, and they cycle a lot of new hunters through that program and gain access to some really beautiful ranches, and also give these landowners a really good opportunity to maintain and manage their animal populations in the absolutely the best way possible, I think. You also know, you talked to Doug Duren, who's also doing very similar things up north. I mean, another really wonderful human being right there who does some really good work. And it's just, I love to see stuff like that. So, you know, I think that, you know, new hunters are always asking, you know, like, well, how do I go about it? And I'm like, get in with these organizations, like just contact them. They're not only going to provide you with resources and contacts, but they're also the ones that we should be supporting right now, because they're advocating for everyone here, navigating a very complicated land situation here in Texas, but I think very, very well. And so I always would encourage anybody that's interested in getting into hunting to, you know, both of those organizations represent some really good opportunities for getting out in the woods.
Yeah, no, I strongly agree. I mean, you know, I talked to Justin, the CEO at TWA, and learned more about what they have going and all the different levels of involvement people can get into, the youth programs, the learn to hunt programs, the different things that are partnered with the Texas Parks and Wildlife, and just getting folks out there. Man, there's so many great opportunities that, you know, I didn't really know or look into before having private land at my disposal. And just seeing how, you know, how would someone start? We had a buddy of ours, Johnny, who had never even fired a rifle a year ago. And so we took him through the idea of like really safety instruction. We kind of did it on our own, buddy Matthew and I, on our land. And he would work on the property, and we're buddies. So it wasn't like, you have to do this or you can't hunt. Like it just ended up being part of the package of like learning to get involved and see a property and really kind of expand your knowledge of that. And then he hunted it. So it was a cool real 360 moment, but that hasn't been available for a lot of people. And I think it can be discouraging, but when you find these programs and these initiatives and these associations that offer these weekends where you can go out there, and in some cases free, or it's a small fee to get in there and get your feet wet and kind of understand. And, you know, I know you've done some stuff too, where you volunteered times for hunts and kind of, you know, been a mentor of sorts too. And I think I kind of want to leave this on that idea too, that you spoke about it in our last podcast, and the idea too of that, the idea of like wanting to teach teachers, like spend it, sharing this knowledge so that those other people can be able to expand upon that and share that knowledge. And whether that's in a kitchen or in the field, I think this idea of mentorship, sharing this collective nature of our knowledge, of really being able to put this out there and what will best benefit our lives, enrichment for getting out there, and also our health for eating really good food, and really for the habitat for our future generations. You know, we have children. We want to leave it better for them, for the grandchildren, for seven generations down the line. So I think it's very imperative that we have that part of the discussion with everything we're doing too, because that conservation and the ethics that are there in place today leave it better tomorrow. And I think that's something that, you know, you've spoken to and wanting to do this in a local way. So I like that you also pinpointed that here and, you know, act local, right? So it's important, man.
Yeah, I couldn't put that better myself. That's awesome.
Well, I stole it from a writing you did earlier. So, you
know. Okay.
Well, is there anything else that you kind of want to, you know, tell people about or kind of let them know, or kind of some final thoughts or words, you know, as we're kind of approaching the turkey season, as it's starting to maybe thaw out a little bit and we're, you know, it's just right around the corner, man. So, if there's any kind of thing you want to give or a message, or maybe just, you know, people that are, have, you know, supported you over these years.
Yeah. I mean, just get out there. I think that, like, if you're new to hunting and you want to get into turkey, I think, you know, do that with a great deal of grace and patience, because that's, they're going to demand that of you. And then if you're an experienced turkey hunter, you know, it's just like, I can't really offer you that much in advice, you know, because I'm still right in the middle. And, you know, just, I feel like I'm a bit of a novice, but I'm just like the happiest of novices, because it's the best school to go to. It's just sitting out there and experiencing turkey season. I love it. I mean, I'm on a countdown right now. I think we're about 7.5 weeks out from my first turkey hunt. Who's counting? You know, I just get out there, you know, and it just, I love that, you know, people are still so motivated to go and do this thing, and that we have so many new people that are interested in it, whether you've been doing it your whole life, or you're just wanting to get into it. There's still so much to be learned about it. And I think just, you know, valuing everything as a resource, whether it is a hog or a turkey, you know, everything is a potential resource, and there's so much that can be done with it, and there's so much enjoyment and so much fulfillment that you get out of being out there. And I'm so happy to be able to be a part of that and get to have conversations like this around that, and basically make that my whole job, you know, which I have a great job, and so I really love it. And so I'm very appreciative when I get an opportunity like this and I come on and talk to you and therefore speak to a bunch of other people about this. And so, yeah, it's just get out there and enjoy it, and remember that it's a blessing to have that, and then we should treat it as such. So it's a real valuable thing, and it will go away if we don't take care of it and if we don't maintain it and admire it on a personal level every time.
Great points there. Great points. Well said, man. Well, everyone go check out DieDewey.com, thewildbooks.com, and Die Dewey. You can be able to search then for Die Dewey or New School Traditional Cookery. There's kind of a branch off there from that. And for those who want to follow you and your journey, can you give them your Instagram handle and where they can find you?
Yeah, it's Sacalay. It's the Southern Louisiana term for a crappie, as we spoke of earlier. It's SAC.A.LAIT. And follow me on Instagram for lots of pictures of turkey.
Yes, hopefully hopefully bunch more this season as well, man. I'm excited for you, man. So as always, I'll let you know whenever we're heading out to the ranch, and when if we can get you out there for turkey hunt and your busy schedule, would love to have you. If not, we'll have some dewberries aplenty to go ahead and pick and hang out with. So we got to make that happen this year.
Perfect.
Good deal. Hey, Jesse, thank you for joining us. I really appreciate it. And all the best and all the success. Congratulations on the turkey book. Cannot wait for that to get in everybody's hands. I was, you know, blessed and honored to get an early sneak peek. And I find it to be one of the most fascinating, best cooking related books I've ever seen. And your writing is second to none. Everyone go check it out. You can pre-order today, get the signed copy. And whenever the NWTF, you know, bundle comes out, make sure you're grabbing that as well, everyone. So thanks again and have a great day.